My next guest, I believe, is on the line. Knaan Lidor is an award-winning journalist and a news correspondent based in Haifa in Israel, affiliated to the Jewish News Syndicate, where he covers global events and anything Jewish-related or Israel-related. So, absolute pleasure to have you again talking to me this afternoon, Knaan.
Hi, thanks for having me. How are things?
Things are good. Not the greatest news coming out of Israel today. And I thought I'm not in a rush. I've got some time. Maybe you can rush. Take us through some of the significant stories of the day. If I just sort of throw them at you, maybe I can have your response to them. The operation in Gaza City looks like it's begun.
Despite the wishes of the top brass of the IDF, they've warned against this operation, but the political echelon has decided to push it through. We're talking about the capture of Gaza City, which is where we're told the thrust of Hamas's power lies, and this will be a fundamental step toward dismantling them. Now, when Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced this, he attached a solemn prediction to this.
Yeah.
He said, and the speech is still reverberating here in Israel, he said, we need to be both Athens and Sparta, and we need to have an autarkic economy because of the growing international isolation that Israel finds itself in. And this is seen as a watershed because it's anathema to everything that the Israeli economy and foreign relations have stood for in the past few decades. More connectivity, more globalism, more trade. And now he's telling us, no, actually, we're going to have to do things internally, and we're going to give up on a lot of that trade and participation, international participation. And it's a very hard message for a lot of people to take, but it also suggests that we have moved past the bluffing stage, because for a few months now, Netanyahu and his ministers have said, "Oh, we're a hair's breadth away from invading Gaza. We're about to take it. It's about to happen." And all the while, Trump, Qatar, Hamas were negotiating about maybe returning the hostages. So it wasn't clear how much of this was positioning. How much of this was a bargaining position? Do this, or else we will invade. But with this statement that Israel is entering a new phase, our economy is not going to be the same for the foreseeable future, that's already a statement that carries political capital for Netanyahu, and so it's seen much more seriously.
Knaan, I believe as a result of that statement, the Tel Aviv Stock Exchange took quite a hit today.
Yes, and that's actually a hit that is still higher than what it was during October 7, 2023. It's actually been performing quite well, despite everything, maybe unintuitively to a lot of people. It's been performing quite well, and now we've seen the first hit because of statements, I believe, from the start of the war. And that's because of what I said, how fundamentally different it is to everything that the Israeli economy has stood for.
Knaan, do you think freeing the hostages is an aim of this latest operation in Gaza City, or do you think that's off the table at this point?
I'm sure that on the tactical and operative level, troops on the ground will act on pieces of information that they come in contact with about the whereabouts of the hostages. But as a strategic overarching goal, it's probably... Let's put it like this. Efforts to retrieve the hostages have been consummated. This is not about retrieving the hostages. This is about the other ends of the war, and they are in conflict with, namely, dismantling Hamas. And that is in conflict with retrieving the hostages, because Hamas is going to do everything possible to either inflict as much pain as possible on Israeli society by killing the hostages, or making them go away, tucking them even deeper, either somehow getting them out of the strip or tucking them even deeper and more difficult to achieve liberation by military means.
Why then is the army as against this operation as it appears to be?
Well, the army is very concerned about the prospect of having to take care of Gaza, because right now, as the legal system in Israel means that the army is going to be the sovereign once you remove all civilian infrastructure in Gaza. Israeli law says that it falls on the army to provide all these solutions to 2 million, 1.5 million, not sure how many are still there, people. And that's something that the army doesn't want to do because it's not built to do it, and because it also makes it very vulnerable to attacks. If it has troops on the ground performing tasks they've not practiced, they've not trained for, in hostile militia, guerrilla style, sorry, environment. So that means casualties, and casualties mean career bumps for the top brass of the IDF. So they know that there's going to be a lot of body bags, and ultimately that's going to come back to them as well as the government, and they don't want it. The IDF has been very good at neutralizing terrorism in short in-out operations. It's demonstrated that both in Gaza and in Judea and Samaria. But right now it's marching into the unknown, and there's nothing more scary to a general than this prospect.
Kanana, I hate the fact that I think this, but aren't Hamas going to get their victory photograph in any event? Aren't they going to come crawling out of those tunnels, and somebody's going to take a picture of somebody with his hand in the air, and isn't that going to be the victory photograph that they're after, and there's nothing Israel can do to stop that?
Well, that really depends on the outcome of this operation. If they're, for example, if they end up losing land to Israel, let's say a generous buffer zone that Israel will take, most probably in the northern strip, well, that's a clear sign of defeat. The land is no longer under your control. If the heads of Hamas are, I'm talking about senior commanders, if they're captured or killed, that's another undeniable victory. And most likely, most reliably, if there are IDF troops or even Arab coalition troops patrolling the streets on the ground with guns, then Hamas can't claim credibly to its population. That's really the only propaganda that Hamas cares about. It can't claim that to its population.
You're now making me go off point and raise something else. There was a conference of Islamic states in Doha a day or two ago. At the beginning of the show, 2 hours ago, I went through some of the very, very vicious responses by apparently allies of Israel, members of the Abraham Accords, countries that have had peace treaties with Israel, Egypt, Jordan, and the likes. Is that realistic to think that there will be Arab peacekeepers patrolling Gaza after the Doha strike?
Let me explain why. Egypt, Hamas is a domestic problem, because Hamas is a branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, and right now the military dictatorship in Egypt is governing without any constitutional legitimacy. After taking power from a Muslim Brotherhood government of Morsi a few years ago. And so if they let this thing spread, unless they actually somehow tamper down on it, or if Israel just pulls out and lets Hamas have its way, it's a disaster for Egypt as well. And Egypt is the leader of the secular Arab world, and Jordan is not in a very different situation, because Hamas agitation means in the Gaza Strip, in Judea and Samaria, means Hamas agitation in Jordan, which is predominantly Palestinian. And so they have their own interests. They will grandstand against Israel in those conferences, but when the rubber hits the road, they'll hunker down and send troops like good little children, as they say.
I hear what you're saying, but do you not think there's a different tone in the comments coming out? I mean, is it grandstanding? I hope it's grandstanding. I'm just not so sure it is.
Well, in terms of their participation in a post-Gaza capture scenario, yes, they will do whatever it takes, because it's not an Israeli interest, it's an internal. But yeah, the rhetoric coming out of Gulf states
was vicious.
Doves with what it just connects to what Netanyahu said. Listen, those days of dreaming about the post-Abraham Accords of Middle East, of high-tech greenhouses and joint ventures and the road to India, all those big dreams, yeah, they're, we need to put that on hold. And that's what those statements coming from the Gulf states also mean.
Oh, that is a very sobering situation to be in. I want to get a little less serious, but that's not the right word because it is serious. It's just less important. I know that you lived in the Netherlands for a while, so things that happen in Netherlands, Belgium, and the like, you're probably up to date with. Lahav Sheni, the conductor of the Israeli Philharmonic. Can you tell us about that incident in Belgium?
Yes. So in last week, the Gent or Jean, that's the French language name of Gent, of this city in Belgium. It's a cultural hub of the Benelux area. They held this classical music festival, and the Munich Philharmonic, no less than the Munich Philharmonic, was supposed to play.
Yeah.
One problem. The conductor of the Munich Philharmonic is Lahav Sheni, a brilliant 30-something old a musician. You know, his brilliance is, of course, reflected in his position, the conductor of that Philharmonic. And it was supposed to be a big honor, a big sign of, you know, inter-EU cross-fertilization. But Gent municipality, the organizers of the festival, and with the support of the Belgian culture minister, pulled the plug on the performance and basically told the Munich Philharmonic it can't play because there's an Israeli Jew, Zio, you pick the term, leading the orchestra. And so there was a big outcry in Belgium, in Germany, that harks back to the days when Jewish artists were boycotted, all that history bubbled right back to the surface. And on Saturday, Bart De Wever, the prime minister of Belgium, actually traveled to Essen, to Germany, to listen to a concert of the Munich Philharmonic and shook hands with Lahav Sheni. And he said, listen, we actually support all the sanctions that the EU want to put on Israel.
Interesting.
But we won't stand for the singling out, the ostracization of individuals, so because that's not who we are.
So interesting, because as you were talking, I was thinking he's got a very large Islamic base in Belgium. A place like Molenbeek, a suburb of Belgium, is apparently the hub of Islamism in Europe. So I didn't see that there was anything in it for him to make such a public statement supporting an Israeli, but you've given me the distinction now. So it was individual as opposed to Israeli.
He's in a tricky position, Bart De Wever, because actually he was one of the few European leaders who said, we're not going to recognize a Palestinian state, because what kind of state are we even talking about? I don't know what state it is. It's not a good idea. He resisted. And then earlier this month, his foreign minister, who comes from a more centrist party, he's right wing. His foreign minister isn't. He said, no, we're recognizing a Palestinian state, but only if they return the hostages and dismantle Hamas. It's a weird kind of compromise. And Bart De Wever probably understood that his political survival depends, despite his personal, friendliness toward Israel, his political survival. He's in a coalition government. It depends on going along with these sanctions. And that's the situation that many European leaders are finding themselves. Even our friends are under such tremendous pressure that they just, because of the base, because of their alliances, they cannot afford to protect us any longer.
Knan, it's been a wonderful 10 minutes. Thank you for that. And I'm just amazed that pretty much anything that I have thrown at you, you have just handled with such aplomb this afternoon. What a pleasure talking to an expert like you. Really, thank you from the bottom of my heart for talking to me on Chai FM this afternoon.